the most important meal of the day, second breakfast.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to another Second Breakfast podcast. I'm Andy Roth alongside Phil Duvall. Say hi, Phil.
Hello, everybody. How are you?
You're aware that you started with like just a visual hello, and then
it's like a gesture. You know, listen. Here's the deal. We, for those who watch us, you got to give them a little something special,
right? But do it at the end of a sound so that the people who are just listening to us are like, "Where is Phil in a box locked away somewhere?"
It's called suspense, Andy, and I am a master of it.
Indeed, you are a latter-day Hitchcock, my friend.
It's true. I wish there was a Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Hitchcocks. It would be a lot more suspenseful than Mormonism. It would be.
Is there a religion today that a Hitchcock religion wouldn't be more suspenseful than?
I mean, look, I'm Christian. I think there's something inherently suspenseful about Christianity because people are like, do I really go to heaven? Or do I burn forever? Although I tend to think that's just bad.
Not if you're Calvinist.
No, I think even more so if you're Calvinist, because blows my mind. Because Calvinists believe that there is this that from before anything was ever created, God already decided who he was going to create and which of them would go to heaven and which would go to hell.
Right, but you
that's
know,
amazing.
It is amazing, but you can tell if you're one of the people because your business does well.
I mean, maybe, I guess. I don't know. I go back and forth on that. Can you tell?
Were I Calvinist, I wouldn't be like, yay, I had a good day at my dry cleaners today. I'm going to kill myself so that I don't have a chance to, you know.
Oh, no, no. So wait, so you said this your extension of, this is a much bigger conversation.
I know.
Are you suggesting that Calvinism says that you can tell if you're saved because everything goes well for you and it's profitable?
I mean, that's what I learned. It could have been wrong.
Where'd you learn that?
In my school,
okay.
Named St. John's. Not parochial, to be fair, but...
No, I know. I know. I'm interested. I'll have to talk to some of my theologian friends. That has not been my impression of John Calvin specifically. It may be the reality for many of his acolytes, because sure. The reality is, I mean, look, Jesus was awesome, and a lot of his acolytes have been terrible. So I'm willing to give that a whirl. There, you know who's Saint? You've heard of Saint Francis of Assisi, right?
I have.
So Saint Francis made this big deal where he was like, "Look, we don't." And, you know, people wanted to follow him. He started his own order, and he's like, "That's fine, but you need to understand something. We don't own anything, ever." Like, we have, like, a tunic and a mat, and that's it. This is a vow of poverty. And a lot of people gave him flack for it, but, like, his followers had to follow the rules. This is what we do. If we're part of this order, we don't do that. We don't accept property. We don't accept donations. Like, we don't take – like, no one could say, we're going to donate this land to you and you can live on it. Not even that, because that's wealth, especially in those days, right?
Right.
What's the first thing that the Franciscan – brothers got rid of after St. Francis died?
That?
Immediately! They were like, well, you know, poverty, we can take land. I mean, come on. So I love that. Like, the moment is he gone? Hold on. Yeah, no, he's gone. All right, call the Pope. Let's get this going now.
Hold the mirror up to his nose. Yeah.
Still breathing. Crap. I mean, this is very sad, very bad. Anyway.
Indeed. Speaking of vows of poverty, it's Wednesday, and that means it's time for another installment of Project Melway.
You could have said, speaking of radical Catholics.
I could have, but that's my way of building suspense.
You're right. Well done, Hitchcock.
Boom!
All right.
Boom!
Project Melway, brought to you by the Gibsonian Institute, has commissioned Andy and me to watch every single Mel Gibson movie in chronological order. And today was the last movie from the year 2000. And I got to tell you, we're getting close to the end, but this has been a good stretch.
Yeah.
It's a good stretch. Even the bad movies. I'm a little like, today was a pretty, I mean, today we watched a movie called What Women Want.
Yes.
And it is, in many ways horrendous, but also in many ways delightful.
Yes.
And surprisingly more delightful than horrendous.
See, I agree with literally every word you just said.
Thank you. Like, thank you. Surprisingly?
Yes, it is surprisingly.
More delightful.
It is surprising.
Than horrendous.
Yes. All three of those things and every combination therein. Yes.
Here's my, okay, before we do the setup of the movie, here's my analysis really quick, if I can put it into one sentence.
I can't.
It's wait. Like someone set a really horrendously, terribly cliched foundation for a movie.
Mm-hmm.
And then Mel Gibson and Helen Hunt and Marissa Tomei just tap danced all over this crappy foundation.
Oh, yes.
Like someone was like, here's a terrible idea and we're just going to make a god awful film. And then Mel Gibson and Helen Hunt and Marissa Tomei and the girl from Arrested Development
Judy Greer.
You know, we always talk about that guys and we never include the women. She's a that gal.
I think it's a gender neutral term. I think she's a that guy. I think she's a that guy as well.
I think she is. And I think she's a voice. I just think she does voice work on Archer. Mm. She's just incredibly special. She really is. It took me a long time to warm up to her because she so blatantly plays difficult people.
Sure.
But she is. Well, we'll talk about her in a little bit. Anyways, that's my premise. That's my setup for this movie, which is that someone created a foundation of craptacularness, and then somehow the main players in this movie just gave it everything, and they humanized it, and they pulled it off.
Yeah. The one-sentence plot synopsis, a chauvinistic ad executive has an accident, and after the accident, he can hear what every woman in the world is thinking, and he uses that to his advantage, and then he doesn't, and blah, 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 and there's a love story, and blah, blah, blah.
Blah, blah, blah.
Yada, yada, yada.
A little bit more blah, blah, blah than necessary. This movie was 2 hours and 7 minutes long.
Oh, yeah. That's
nice. And then had no denouement.
Right. 2 hours and 7 minutes, and it resolves at 2 hours, 6 minutes, and 53 seconds. Like,
right. So, and here's the thing, right? If your movie's too long, which this movie is too long.
It's true.
And I'll go ahead and say all Nancy Meyers comedies that I have seen are too long. She makes 2+ hour romantic comedies.
Woof.
Nancy, an hour and 45 minutes. Come on. Seriously.
Yeah.
You're not bad. I can't relate to any of your characters ever, but you're not bad at what you do.
Sure.
Please, for the love of God, make shorter movies. But if you're, it's like Lord of the Rings. It's like Return of the King. Everyone's like, well, they had 3 endings. Yeah, it was ending a 12-hour story. At some point, you're like, forget it. We're going to show a bunch of endings because we need to wrap a lot of stuff up. And if you're in this far, you're in. So yes. For Nancy Meyers to do a 2-hour and 7-minute movie and then not give us any – like literally, they kiss, spoiler, and the credits roll.
Yeah.
And I was like, what?
Yeah.
The next day at work? Anything? Just anything?
Yes. Yes.
Straight.
Yes. So I want to – we can talk about this at length now or later or never, frankly. But this movie, in many ways, to me, was Mel Gibson at his Mel Gibsoniest.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, it's almost like his movie, like a proto movie. Okay.
The only reason I would have a hard time believing that I'm ready to hear your argument.
Okay.
But the only thing I would say is that it's hard for me to believe that because it's a straight comedy and he's only done 2 of them.
Fair.
So you don't see the dark side of Mel too much in this film.
Agreed. But if we look at him, how to put this? This is the movie of movie star Mel, not necessarily actor.
Aha! Well said, Roth.
And I didn't sort of parse it until you said that. I thank you for that because I agree with you. I mean, he certainly has a dark side that he taps into frequently and well. He is the best male crier in Hollywood, and he doesn't tap into that in this movie.
I think you got to go with Lethal Weapon 2 as the quintessential Mel Gibson film.
I think that's probably true.
For the whole gamut, so you get the everything. Because we know he cries in Lethal Weapon 2.
It's true.
all right.
There's so many things that like, if I'm a movie star, these are things that I can do, and I should do, and they're all in this movie. There's like hilarious Three's Company style cross-dressing and misunderstanding.
Right.
There's a romance.
I'm just trying this on.
Right. There's a romance. There is an inexplicable dance number to Sinatra.
Can we talk? Can we talk about that now, or do you want to talk about it later? I have so many opinions about this.
One last thing, and then sort of the bedrock upon which my entire argument is based: a plot and a characterization that depends 100% on charisma and literally nothing else.
If you don't, you are 100% right. I mean, that's the point. That's why the movie works, because Mel Gibson, like,
yes, and which is what you said
up,
earlier,
throws
right?
it on his back.
Yes,
I mean, yes. He's not alone. We'll talk about Helen Hunt in a little bit. Yeah. I thought her performance was lovely.
I agree.
In the best sense of that word. And Alan Alda was Alan Alda. He did what Alan Alda does.
Sure.
And Marissa Tomei. My wife, we sat down, and my wife goes, "You just wanted to watch this because Marissa Tomei was in it." And I go, hey, it's Project Melway. I have to watch this. That being said, I'm not terribly sad about seeing
that being said, honey, you're totally right.
I referred to her as my girlfriend. My wife knows. I mean, listen, there's almost and that we set the a long time ago. I said, honey, I met you in 2006. I've known Marissa Tomei since 1992.
It's a fair point.
You gotta just allow for certain things.
Absolutely. So Sinatra dance number.
Oh my gosh. Okay. First of all, the whole first 20 really what's funny is the premise of the movie is that he gets electrocuted and wakes up and is able to hear what women think. And from that point on, what blows, which is totally, of course, fantastical and unrealistic, as we know, that goes without saying. But what I find amazing about it is that's when his character actually becomes something resembling a human being.
Yes.
That up until that point, he is literally a caricature doing things of a human being. He's like, hey, babe. Hey, honey pie. Hey, what's up? Ooh, ah. Like walking down the street, like going, like making faces, like hamming it up, walking down the streets of Chicago. Now, listen, I've never walked down the streets of Chicago.
Sure.
But I have doubts. I have doubts that there are people at all in the world who act like this. One. Two. That dance sequence? WTH. I can't even.
I know.
But, and by the way, the whole like, too much estrogen, I need to listen to Frank. Okay, I'm not going to blame Mel Gibson for that terrible line, because then you listen to Frank Sinatra, who every single one of his songs is about women.
Yeah, so, it's true.
And like, he may have a reputation as being like, hey, the ladies man, but like, his songs aren't in any way macho. They're all like, I love you all the time.
He is not in his songs in any way an alpha male.
No. Okay, I mean, except for like My Way, which is, again, it's unindicative of his.
Very briefly, to go off of your, like, the beginning, he's nothing but a caricature. How do we show that he's an absent-minded father? He doesn't know how old his daughter is.
Right. I mean, and she calls him by his first name.
Right.
I don't know a father who wouldn't know how old his daughter is.
I mean, the worst father in the world.
Yeah. Yeah, I would think. That would be my guess. It's pretty lame. But then he just decides to dance. And here's the thing. It's terrible, like the idea behind it. And the whole idea of him like pulling the cork of the wine out with his mouth and then pouring it all and it's like, it's literally like, let's make a scene where you're getting drunk. Except here's the deal. Mel Gibson, it turns out, has moves.
Yeah.
He's a phenomenal dancer.
Yes.
I'll go so far as to say, because of this movie, I believe Mel Gibson could be a phenomenal physical comedian.
Mm-hmm.
Which I never saw coming. And he pulls it off because seriously, he can dance.
Yeah.
Like, it was straight out of, it was straight out of like, I'm not going to say he's as good as Gene Kelly, but I mean, it's that kind of thing where he just like, he's dancing with the coat rack and
he's much more
flipping the hat. And
yes, he's much more a Gene Kelly sort of muscular dancer than like a Fred Astaire graceful dancer.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, those are arbitrary distinctions anyway, and they're both wonderful. And Mel Gibson is you're right. He is not Gene Kelly, but nobody's Gene Kelly. And he acquits himself quite well.
Only Gene Kelly's Gene Kelly. That's why they call him Gene Kelly.
It's true.
But I couldn't believe, I was surprised by that scene and how ridiculous it was and by how charming it was in the midst of its ridiculousness. Did not see that coming one bit, one iota.
I wonder if he has a big, like, singing part in, or singing and or dancing part in The Singing Detective.
Looking forward to seeing and finding out.
Yeah, coming because soon. I think he could, because I would be surprised if he would do badly in a musical. You know what I mean? Yeah. I think he could totally do it.
They should have cast him as Russell Crowe's part in Les Mis.
They should have cast literally anyone as Russell.
I was fine with Russell Crowe, actually. I'm a deep Russell Crowe apologist.
Fair. Normally I am too, but even this one, I couldn't. I just couldn't.
I'd like to see it with someone else just so I could prove that that was still terrible regardless of who was in it. I doubt that it would have been good regardless.
Fair. Very briefly, I didn't like that movie, but the complaint that there were too many close-ups is just the most infuriating complaint ever. Because
My complaint is with the actual, like, movie, not with the way it was made. I thought the way it was made was fine.
Like, why are you upset that they are doing something that you can do in cinema that you cannot do on stage? Namely,
also,
zoom in.
Right. Right. I'd also like to say, first of all, fantastic point, Andy Roth. Secondly, I think people who say stuff like that, my guess, they don't actually know anything about movies, and it just sounds like something they're supposed to say.
Right.
Like, oh, it had too many close-ups. Really? How's too many? How many is too many? I saw someone say that on the TV, and I sound smart. No,
right.
You sound like a jerk.
Right.
So, anyways, back to what women want. What do women want, Andy?
They want to be listened to, Phil.
That's pretty much it, isn't it?
Yeah. You know what we just did? We told it in less than 2 hours and 7 minutes.
No, but I'll tell you what. Our version didn't have Helen Hunt or Marissa Tomei fail.
It's true.
And on top of that, I got to say, I was surprised by the part by how affecting this movie was, in the sense that I really did feel like when I was watching, like, well, and part of that again is Mel Gibson, that, like, they did portray this idea that, wait a minute, all women want actually is to be listened to, heard, mm-hmm. and treated like human beings, shockingly.
Right.
I don't
stunningly
believe that. I also think they want to be right all the time, and they want us to suffer. But I think that's, you know, that's just my own personal exegesis of the situation. So
sure.
But I thought they actually did a good job of showing that. Like,
I did too.
There wasn't, I mean, I think there's something to be said for a female director. I think there's something to be said that Nancy Myers makes romantic comedies. And I think think about it this way. Think about her. I never saw The Holiday, but her three biggest are this, Something's Gotta Give, and the one with Alec Baldwin and Meryl Streep and Steve Martin. Is it It's Complicated?
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. All three I have so many problems with, I can't even begin to tell you. Sure. But in the first one, it's basically about Mel Gibson learning about women. Mm-hmm. But the women are all drawn really beautifully, like really well portrayed.
Okay.
The second one, it's basically – it's half and half. You've got – it's really about Diane Keaton and Jack Nicholson at the same time, but it's still kind of leaning towards Jack Nicholson. Mm-hmm. By It's Complicated, that movie's about the woman.
Yeah.
And the men really are second to the woman in that movie.
Sure.
And I appreciate that. I appreciate seeing a romantic comedy that's actually since by the way, women are the target audience of a romantic comedy, let's be honest.
You're right. You're right. And that's a good point. That's a good point. It is clear – that this movie is not told, even though the plot just could not be more formulaic. It is clear that this movie is coming from a non-formulaic point of view or place. I will say this. I agree with you that it was affecting, like that part of the storyline was affecting, but everything else, I didn't buy it when it tried to get serious. Or let me put it this way. I did, but only because Marissa Tomei and Judy Greer knocked it out of the park.
Yep. Too many subplots. There were too many. It was trying to fit way too many things in, right? It was trying to fit in the romantic. I mean, here's the thing. The Marissa Tomei plot line was, I think, completely unnecessary. And I...
You know, it was totally unnecessary. You know why it was there? It was there for the moment where in the extraordinarily subtle metaphor, if you listen to your sexual partner, you will be better in bed. That was it.
Right.
That was it.
Which I feel like they could have incorporated into his relationship with Helen Hunt, but perhaps they didn't want to show Helen Hunt having sex.
Right.
That's fair. She took care of that in the sessions, so no problem.
She did.
A movie I'd love to talk about sometime. But Marissa Tomei's character, I mean, what?
Marissa Tomei, she does a great job. She basically takes a completely useless part and makes it something.
Yes, agreed.
Which I would say she and Mel Gibson and Helen Hunt take a completely useless movie and make it something. But
agreed.
But I think she made her part something. Like, to the degree that when I was thinking last night, what would I have gotten rid of? I actually didn't think about that. And then now that we've talked about it, it's like, yeah, you get rid of that for the sake of the movie, but that would be terrible because she's so great. I mean, so good in it.
I agree with you. And I didn't think about it. I thought it was too long, but it didn't occur to me when thinking about what I would cut.
Let's talk about the Judy Greer suicide subplot.
Yes. So here's what I wrote down for this. Also, thank God, because I was like, thank God for Marissa Tomei, thank God for Mel Gibson, thank God for Helen Hunt, thank God for Bette Midler, one scene, she does a bang up job.
she does. It's a ridiculous.
It's totally ridiculous, but the movie is ridiculous.
Can I say something about this?
Go for it.
I found her really attractive in that scene.
Me too.
I wasn't ready to find Bette Midler attractive.
I
plus Bette Midler from the year 2000. I don't even know how old she was at that point. She was probably already 75. But I'm looking up how old Bette Midler is right now. Bette Midler was born in 45. Oh, God, she's older than my father. Oh.
Okay.
That's hard for me. This is hard for me.
We're getting back to Judy Greer now. So, also, thank God for Judy Greer, who literally
she
could not
55.
Be...
She was
55. Welcome to the world, Phil. Also, thank God for Judy Greer, who literally could not be more wonderful. Having said that, this part I wrote before the resolution of her storyline. Having said that, I don't know if I love her storyline. This movie is at its best when it's uber frothy. And I stand by that. Although I agree with you that it is affecting when it comes to the women just want to be listened to, it's still at its best when it's making its point lightly. Mm-hmm. The suicide stuff seems out of place. And then, you know what I thought of? It was like a pale imitation of the old guy dying in Groundhog Day. It's like, I need to find meaning in something. And there's that both movies manufacture this pathos, but the difference is the while it is manufactured in Groundhog Day, it doesn't feel manufactured. And that's because there is emotional resonance anchoring it to reality. Two ridiculous movies, as in they are rooted in the fantastical, but Groundhog Day takes this, and that is in many ways, it's not the centerpiece of the movie, but it is a centerpiece of one of the things he has to learn.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the same thing that the Judy Greer character is. Like he needs to learn, like it's not just listening to people. It's really, it's really
caring.
Them.
It's listening, yes. It's hearing, it's caring. I think yes. You can make a good point. I mean, I think, yeah, that's right. That's another, it's a subplot that makes the movie too long again, but at the same time, Judy Greer does such a phenomenal job.
She does.
By the way, and here's, I'm going to say it all over again. Are you ready?
Hmm.
In the scene where he comes to her apartment to save her life.
Yep.
She's really cute in that scene too.
It's true.
She benefited from the Mel Gibson effect.
It's true. You're
Mel
right.
Gibson effect. Ladies and gentlemen, the Mel Gibson effect is when a woman is in a movie and be opposite Mel Gibson and it makes her more attractive. And this works for Helen Hunt. This works for Judy Greer. This works for Bette Midler. Mel Gibson is just painting the town. I'm not going to say it works for Marissa Tomei, although she is so fetching in this movie.
Hey, you're right.
It doesn't matter because she is in everything. But that scene where she's flirting with him at the coffee shop is like, if you could bottle that up and sell it, you would be a billionaire.
You're right. Yeah, just to put a bow on Judy Greer's character, the only reason that scene works is because MG and JG just kill it.
Yeah.
They kill it in that scene.
And go ahead.
Well, just very briefly, that scene also is, of course, the scene where it's like, oh, now he no longer has the power. but he still cares. But most importantly, he, like, it's a plot scene, right? Like he no longer has the power because he can't hear what she's thinking.
Yeah.
But it's not like they couldn't. But again, even though Judy Greer is wonderful, totally unnecessary subplot, that they could have shown him losing the power or without the power literally a shmillion different ways. You know.
But they did it with a magical Chinese lady in the rainstorm.
Yes.
Which was just...
Yes.
This movie in many ways doesn't know what's going on. And it's a testament. But Nancy Myers also didn't write it. She wrote the other movies I mentioned. So she didn't even... She did not write it. So I'm interested to see... I mean, I think she took ownership of her movies more later. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't know how she got affiliated with this movie. I didn't watch the making of featurette on my DVD, which I could have. But we're beating around the bush to something that I think, as I'm realizing, has happened now. And I didn't know this was going to happen when we undertook Project Melway Andy, but I think I'm ready to say it.
Talk to me.
I've fallen in love with Mel Gibson as an actor. Like, I always admired him as a star, or, I mean, the reason we did this in the first place was the sort of affinity that I had for him, partially based on the fact that he's a public Christian who's basically a total disaster and has fallen apart, and I see him in many tragic aspects, and I'm always drawn to tragic characters, so I'm always like, he fascinates me, and I grew up with him, so it's like, oh, this guy that I grew up with is really dark and twisted and fascinating,
right.
And someone who represents my faith is doing all sorts of good and bad things with it, and I'm curious about that. Now, all that being said, I wasn't prepared for the fact that I was really going to say a movie like this movie and go, wow, do you know what really carries this movie? Mel Gibson's performance. I didn't know that that was going to come out of this.
Sure.
And Mel Gibson's performance in this movie is he's just a really good actor. And there's moments you can see him, you can see his character differentiate between when he's putting on a show as the character. And I don't even just mean the early scenes and the later scenes. I mean, within one scene, you can see like the switch between I'm trying to be this thing and then like the authentic guy.
Yeah.
He is able to perform authentic emotion in a way that is just really unparalleled. I mean, it's really special, at least in modern cinema. You don't see guys that like, I just think he can pretty much name an emotion. You know, I keep thinking of Keanu Reeves, and people bash Keanu Reeves. I think Keanu Reeves is a perfectly serviceable actor who does a lot of good work.
Me too.
I don't think anyone else could have played Neo. I don't think anyone else could have played Ted.
No.
I don't think anyone else could have played Todd with one D from Parenthood. And that's like, it's great, but part of the reason you're laughing is because of that scene where he's talking to the mom in the kitchen while drinking the milk out of her carton.
Yes.
And like,
I got to go pick her up from school. These haircuts. I don't know what we were thinking.
That whole thing where he's like, I can't quote the whole line about, you got to get a license to own a dog. You got to get all that stuff.
Yes.
You got to get a license to drive. You got a license to fish. Hell, you even got to get a license to own a dog. But anyways, I mean, that whole monologue. But I'm not going to say that you can see that Keanu Reeves is someone with whom you can see just any.
Right.
And he is a very specific actor who does very specific things.
Yes.
And Gibson, I now believe, it's like, what do you got?
Yeah.
I'll say I don't love Mel Gibson as a movie star, but I do love him as an actor. And if anything, if there's any hope for the next generation of Gibson, it's that he comes out of this thing less in the midst of being a movie star and just acts in whatever he wants.
I think to whatever extent his public issues can be traced to his career, I think they can all be traced to the movie star Mel, not to the actor Mel.
Yeah. Oh, in fact, the thing that has saved him has been that unanimously the people who have worked with him on sets are like, he's the most dear man. Like,
yes.
You know, Jodie Foster, Robert Downey Jr., but those are just two. I mean, Donald Glover. That's the guy from Community. Glover.
Danny Glover.
Jeez, Danny Glover. I wasn't that far off. Donald Glover, Danny Glover. I know. And then it's Phil at his racist best.
I just like I knew the name until you said it wrong. And then it was like, whoop, went out of my head.
Corey
which
Glover?
Is sure
it's
the
Glover.
Same thing that happened to you.
Anyway, so Danny Glover, I mean, like, Richard Donner, clearly, I mean, Julia Roberts, clearly yes. People love working with him, and right. he is someone that just people who work with him really admire him. So you're right. I think that makes a lot of sense. It's movie star Mel. It's alcoholic fundamentalist Catholic Mel has fallen
right.
apart.
And,
you know,
and, not for nothing. He wouldn't be the first Hollywood star to turn to alcohol, right? So it's like.
Well, and from what we understand, it was actually a problem from very, very early
right.
on.
And I'm not
but no, but I know what you mean. Like, he wouldn't be the first artist with alcohol issues.
Right, right. And I'm not going to blame it on Hollywood, but it's certainly an enabling culture. And it's not an enabling culture because of his acting. It's an enabling culture because of publicity and because yeah. of paparazzi and because
You're
of
right.
the movie star. I agree with you. I agree with you. And
you know, wait, so you know who is to blame, right?
Who's that?
The Jews.
Oh. My dad watches this podcast, dude.
Well, if he does, Mr. Roth Esquire, if you're watching this, you already know I love the. I mean, clearly, I love the Jews. I think I've made this abundantly clear how I feel about the tribe.
You have. You have. It's true.
So I feel almost like it's like I'm gonna. It's like the gay thing. It's like. Dude, I have a gay dad. I can say anything I want. And, I mean, I know some people will say, no, you can't. You still have to be careful. But I'm like, no, you're right. I have to be careful. But in my heart, I know where I am with the gays.
Yeah,
like,
true.
I'm not worried.
No, right.
So that's how I feel about the Jews. But that being said, clearly, it's the Jews' fault that Mel Gibson went crazy.
Clearly. So okay. A few things.
Yes.
And actually, I'll start with what you just said, the gay thing.
They had to do it.
Thing I really appreciated, because we've seen him do it before. We've seen him be like, my character is straight. Oh, now I'm gay.
Burn on a wire. Plays the full on flaming.
And I appreciated that it was, and I'm not going to say it's because he's a much better actor now, although that might be part of it. I'm not going to say it's because of Nancy Meyers' direction, although that might be part of it. This is certainly even though it's not a subtle movie, it is more subtle than Bird on a Wire. And when he tells Marissa Tomei that he's gay, it is significantly, he is much more understated in that
he
moment.
He does do a little thing with his arms. He shoots out his arms.
Yes, he does, but that's right at the end. And
my wife knows how I am about that stuff. She literally looked over at me to get my reaction because she knew I was going to be like, I was just like.
Let me say this.
But I totally agree with you.
Because it
it's
came
not
at the end like that. I agree. So because
how gay are you? That, really gay.
Yes.
Really.
Because it came at the end like that. Unlike Bird on a Wire, it didn't seem like Mel Gibson playing gay. It seemed like his character playing gay.
I hear you, and it's really only for a brief minute. The only thing I'll say about it is, and this leads me to another point about this movie. Okay, the only thing I'll say about it is, because I agree with you, it is much more sympathetic than a lot of the portrayals or language of gay people that we've seen so far in Project Melway. But
True. There
is the idea that Marissa Tomei's character goes, and maybe it says more about her character than it does about the writers, I'm not sure.
Mm.
You must be gay because you understand women so well. That's
right.
The idea.
Yes.
And I was like, you think like a woman. You know how women think. You understand our bodies so well and our minds. You must be gay.
Yes.
And I was like, that's probably the year 2000's version of being compassionate and understanding. which leads me to my larger point. This movie is from the year 2000. That makes it 13 years old.
Mm-hmm.
It feels at least 20 years old.
I agree.
This movie feels like nothing from our era.
Yes.
It feels like nothing that is any remotely like Lethal Weapon could come out today and it would look like half the movies we see.
Sure.
What Women Want doesn't resemble any romantic comedy that would come out today,
no.
I feel like.
Yes. My note for comparing it to the Bird on a Wire scene is that Bird on a Wire, he's basically Harvey Fierstein backstage at a Barbara Streisand concert.
Right,
and
right,
this
right.
one he's actually acting.
I hear that, although I do think, like, Harvey Fierstein exists. Like,
I mean, that's true.
Louis C.K. does a whole bit where he's like, look, not all gay people like that, but there are gay people who are like, hello! Like, that is a thing.
You're right.
So, but I know what you mean. I definitely know what you mean. The bird on a wire, like, it's this sort of like, you're just like, oh my gosh, you're so, you must hate them so deeply. But in this movie, it doesn't feel like that. Right. I think that's a good point. But this movie, do you know what I mean when I say this movie feels much older than it is?
I do. One scene, well, all the scenes between, I'll say it, all the scenes between Mel Gibson and Helen Hunt could be, I mean, honestly, they could be Cary Grant and Katharine Hepburn. You know, they
can just, can we talk about, we have gone this far and we haven't talked about Helen Hunt.
She is glorious.
Yeah.
She's, and you know, you talk about the Mel Gibson effect and she is as beautiful or more beautiful in this movie than she is in any
other. She's more attractive in this movie than maybe any movie I've seen.
Sure. But he does that with everyone, right? That's the Mel Gibson effect.
It's like putting pinstripes on any old. I went and saw the Angels and the Yankees this week. Their lineup, Andy, it's like the Island of Castaway Misfit Toys. It's like Jason Nix and Travis Hafner and Travis Hafner's doing and Ichiro Suzuki.
And they're all hitting 285 or higher.
And they're all, and they were winning. Right. It's like, what is that? I was like, Travis Hafner got up and I was like, he's still alive, and he hit a 3-run home run. And I was like, of course you did. Of course you hit a 3-run home run. Anyways, that's the Mel Gibson effect,
yes,
people.
But it's rare. It's happened, but it's rare that, as we've said, he is a phenomenal actor. It's rare that that beautiful woman across from him has the acting chops to stand up to him. And Helen Hunt does. And she
really does.
And not only does she have the talent, she has the charisma. She has the talent to stand up to his talent and the charisma to stand up to his charisma. And so the dinner scene that ends with him kissing.
Yeah. She makes it not a Mel Gibson movie. She makes it a Mel Gibson Helen Hunt movie.
Yes.
There could have been more. And I think what I would have liked more about if they had gotten rid of some of the subplots is it really would have been more about Helen Hunt and it would have been equal. Because basically the best parts of that movie are the parts when they're together.
Absolutely.
The thing about Helen Hunt, she is very attractive, and that's important to say because I think it's not her biggest quality. Like, there's some actors where they're like, but she almost gets a bad rap. Like, people, no, I mean, she almost gets a bad rap. Like, she's not beautiful enough, whereas she's beautiful. But it's not her prominent feature. Her prominent feature is that she is clearly one of the most intelligent women working in film.
Yes,
she exudes intelligence.
Yep.
She's just so smart, and I have no idea where she went to school. I have no idea if she's really smart in real life, like in the sense of like, although I mean, like, I have no proof of it, but right. I will bet dollars to donuts. I will bet it. I there's just no question. She is an incredibly intelligent person who's meant to be an actor because her acting is intelligent.
Yes.
And I don't know how to what that means. Like, I don't know what it means other than that. I don't know how to describe it other than to say she's a really intelligent actor.
Let me, if I can illustrate that, because I think you're absolutely right. One thing that she's really good at playing, she's really good at playing just about everything, but one thing she's really good at playing that you cannot play well unless you are an intelligent actor is, I almost believe the situation in front of me, yet I do not quite believe it. And it's like the...
Because I'm too smart for it.
Right. It was like, come again? One more time?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
And doing that is like, that's the poor man's version. But it is taking it all in, and you see her taking it in and processing it, and you're like, okay, these things make sense, these things do not.
Yeah.
What am I left with?
Yeah.
I also want to say this, Phil. You know this, although you likely have forgotten because it was not an important thing. I do not usually name drop, but that is only because I don't usually have the ability to do so. But I have had dinner with Helen Hunt.
Of course I knew you did. Come on. Of course I knew you did.
Got it. And she is a charming companion. Also, she thinks I'm funny and I can die now.
So Hank Azaria came to Tufts, because Hank Azaria went to Tufts and they gave him an award. They have an award called The Light on the Hill, which is an award you win if you've done anything in the world and you're from Tufts. So they only give it out once every 20 years because... No one from Tufts ever goes on to do anything.
Keep the gloves up. Keep them up.
But But what I'll never forget that his, do you remember what his stipulation for?
Yes, he was like, I will only come back if I get to talk to the Student Drama Society.
Right. And really no one else was invited. Like, you couldn't come in unless you were part of that group.
Yes.
And you and I were part of that. And you were actually, were you president of the drama? I was never elected to anything. And
did
so,
you run for anything?
No, do you remember that time? Oh, you don't remember this. No, they were like, we're opening nominations for president. And someone was like, I think it was my sophomore year. And they were like, Philip Duvall. And I was like, decline. And then they go, all right, opening up nominations for vice president. And someone goes, Philip Duvall. And I go, decline. And it got down to treasurer and someone looked over at me and I was like, and they were like, never mind. Didn't even try. So I was I was president of student council in eighth grade and I got pretty burned on that.
that was enough for you?
I was done. I don't ever want to be elected to anything again. And I haven't been in charge of anything until now. I'm in charge of a church and it's just terrifying. They should not have let me do this. I have flashbacks to eighth grade. They're like, they're going to hate the dance. So Hank Azaria came.
Yep.
And it was right before he and Helen Hunt, we didn't know this, but it was really close to the time right before they broke up.
Within a year. Yeah.
Oh, so sad. I don't know. I'm still pining for that relationship 13 years later, which is none of my business.
Me neither.
Hank Azaria and Helen Hunt came and they sat and they did a Q&A and it was right. I mean, she'd won an Oscar. This was right around the time this movie was made.
Yes.
She'd won an Oscar for Best Actress.
Yep.
And she was more successful than him by far at the time. She still probably is, actually.
Yes.
But you can tell she didn't go to
Godzilla.
She didn't go to Tufts. She didn't win an Atlanta and the Hill Award. Right. So anyways, they came and they spoke, and I didn't realize you guys got to have dinner with them.
There was the Light on the Hill banquet, and it was a bunch of tables, and it was me, and I want to say
the Illuminati.
It's true. So there were a bunch of tables, and there was another board member, Colin. I'm almost positive went as well, and it was the two of us. He was not seated at our table, but because I was, I guess, the big kahuna. I was not only at the dinner, I was at Hank Azaria and Helen Hunt's table. And I forget who was on my left, but on my right was Helen Hunt.
On your left was not Hank Azaria.
No.
You weren't seated betwixt them.
Strangely, I was not betwixt Azaria and Hunt. And
so what was she like as a dinner companion?
I mean, Phil, we quoted Mel Brooks to each other.
Oh!
I know. She could not be more adorable.
Do you know what I said? You know the first thing I said to Hank Azaria when I met him?
What's that?
Dude, what was it like working with Tom Waits? Because Tom Waits was in Mystery Men. And I was like, Hank, it's nice to meet you. What was it like working with Tom Waits?
Awesome.
And he was like, ha! God, you know how many people asked me that? And I was like, yeah, now answer the question. Like, I mean, I love Hank Azaria from The Simpsons, but really, tell me about one of the greatest people who ever lived.
No, totally.
No, I think that would be really cool. You know, the trick to hanging out with famous people is to talk to them about other people that you both admire. That's the trick,
right?
So that you don't because otherwise you just gush and act like a jerk face.
Yes,
you were so good at Project X.
Nice. I'm reasonably sure I gushed and acted like a jerk face. But she was extraordinarily gracious. And
can we say gracious? Can we say graceful about Helen Hunt?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I think she's great in this movie. I really do. I think she lifts it up. And this is an example. We've talked about this before. I was complaining about it on yesterday's podcast that a lot of times you get famous actor and then random hot up-and-coming female.
Right.
And this movie, Nancy Myers doesn't do that, first of all. Nancy Myers doesn't do that,
right?
And I appreciate that about her. Mm-hmm. And secondly, this movie, it's like they're only 5 years apart age wise. Mm-hmm. Her character is, in my opinion, clearly smarter than his character.
Clearly.
And much like what she does to Melvin in As Good as It Gets, like she makes
him a better
Nick.
Man.
She makes him a better man. She makes him want to be a better man. And then she makes him a better man by virtue of the strength and power of her character. She should play, she would have been a great second. Instead of Rene Russo, she would have been a great Thor's wife or Odin's wife.
Yes.
She'd be a great, like, goddess in something.
Yes. You know what she, I'd like I to mean, s- I'm sure fanboys will stalk me and kill me for saying this, but I think she'd be really great as the Invisible Woman in Fantastic Four. Clearly smart.
Yeah.
She's the character is much older than Jessica Alba was when she played her. I mean, as old as Reed Richards, who has gray in his hair. So,
right.
You know, I think.
Let's get Helen Hunt.
Yeah.
Let's get her back in action. I don't know what her deal is, but she needs to be in a lot more things.
I mean, she was just nominated for The Sessions, wasn't she? Like, she's around.
So. I hope that's a start. I hope that jump starts, because you just said she was nominated for The Sessions, and mm-hmm. I think you and I were the only people who saw it, so I'm not really sure how it got nominated.
It's true. God, she's so good in it. Oh, and John Hawks. So one more performance I want to bring up, and we don't have to talk about it for long, but Ashley Johnson as his daughter. I will say this, that father-daughter relationship, minus the, I don't know how old my daughter is, and I'm going to call my dad by his first name.
Yeah.
Minus those two things, it is a completely believable father-daughter thing.
Yes, and the reason is that they're willing to leave things unresolved.
Yes.
That they're willing to show scenes where she walks away angry and he doesn't have the right thing to say, period.
Yes. Yes.
They're willing to show him frustrated and confused. And I agree.
The prom dress trying on scene is adorbs. It is just...
It's a hot mess.
It's adorable. It's an adorable hot mess. I agree with you. But you don't care. Or I didn't.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I want to make sure that we're clear when we talk about... We've said a lot of good things about this movie. This is not a good movie.
Not a good movie. Can I say a couple things about that? Okay.
I mean, the whole thing between him and his buddy, like the other male that's like
Mark Foyer
typical terrible human being character, which is basically all he plays.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
He's the poor man's Jewish Mel Gibson. He's just impossibly handsome, but not as impossibly handsome as Mel. And he's got charisma to burn, but not as much as Mel.
Mel Gibson's charisma could light Las Vegas for a year.
It's true.
All right, what were you going to say?
So there are two things that I noticed. These are not the only two things I had a problem with in the movie, but it's a movie that makes you want to talk about the good things because of Gibson, Hunt, Tomei, Alan Alda, Ashley Johnson, all of these people. Okay. I'm nitpicking, okay? I know that I am a grammar Nazi.
Okay.
I know that only the advent of DVDs made this easy to check. But,
oh boy,
I promise you I caught it without, it didn't matter there was on DVD, because I caught it the first time. During the montage where he is stealing her ideas and you're seeing, like she brings in an idea and Alan Alda holds up like, Nick already brought me this, right?
Right.
There's one where there's a lady windsurfing it's a Visa ad. And there's a woman windsurfing, and Mel has preempted her with a strikingly similar ad. But on her board, on her poster board or whatever, her ad slogan is "Life, live it to its fullest."
Okay.
They spell "its" with an apostrophe.
No.
Yes. It is. I just
flames.
Flames on the
side of my face.
Breathing
flames.
Here's what bugs me about that. Not only did Helen Hunt and Alan Alda see that on set, but how many hands did that poster board go, like was that poster board in?
I love that you're bringing this up. Yeah.
Just infuriating. Oh, it's so, so angry. Here's the other thing. And this is...
Go on.
I think this is, and this was just weird. Like it wasn't, it's not even good or bad, but I was like, that's a weird, and this is not an association I normally make. And I'm going to skirt the fact that we are family friendly here. Okay. I'm not, there's nothing that's truly not family friendly, but there are implications. So his assistant, played by Sarah Paulson, who is also very good, is when he wins her over, when he can read her mind, she's got this boyfriend in Israel who doesn't want to move to Chicago. But she's like,
right.
I have to be here. He's like a writer or something. He can be anywhere. It's like, you need to come here. And he's like, and Mel Gibson says, so how'd it go? Because she gives him an ultimatum, like you need to move here. And the call broke up or something, and she's like, I don't know what it was, but it certainly isn't something positive, like, you got it. See you next Tuesday.
Right.
See you next Tuesday?
That made me very uncomfortable.
Right? Is that an accident? Like, did no one catch that, or is that just totally a coincidence?
I'm so glad you said that, because I would have forgotten to say it. But when she said it, I was like, could you have picked any other day?
Literally any other day. John Landis has See You Next Wednesday. Do an homage to John Landis. Go your own way. Make it Thursday. It was a weird moment. Because that doesn't mean something positive.
It means something very negative.
It means something very negative.
Together we could be Jiminy Glick. That doesn't mean something positive. That means something very negative. Dude, one day you're gonna start watching Curb Your Enthusiasm. I can't wait for that day. But there is a scene where he runs into Martin Short on the street and basically and they're friends, and he's like, Marty, just teach me how to do Jiminy Glick. And it's just them going back and forth for like 5 minutes.
Awesome.
I really can't wait. You know, I really can't wait till you start watching Curb Your Enthusiasm. It's going to change your life. Curb Your Enthusiasm and Deadwood. And then I won't even have to be a person anymore because you will have taken me over.
Nice. I'm reasonably sure your church doesn't want me in charge.
I'm sure you'll be fine.
Fair. I want to very, very briefly, because we should wrap up, because this is a frothy movie that doesn't deserve the level of analysis we've given it. The ending... I didn't love, because I thought Helen Hunt came off as a jerk, because she fires him.
Yeah.
And I feel, maybe it's just because I'm older, but although I think it is truncated, because I'd love to see the next day, like, does the firing stick? You don't know. I mean, you assume it does, but I don't know. But I do think it works.
A denouement would have been nice.
Yeah, it would have been nice just because... But if for no other reason, then I really like those two characters. I would, even in a movie that is too long, I would not have minded another scene with them.
I would have said, if for no other reason, then a denouement is part of the structure of any three-act anything since the history of forever. That's how it works when you tell a story. I learned that in eighth grade.
Yeah.
Seventh grade.
Yeah.
In seventh grade English, Mrs. Beebe, I learned what a denouement was. That's not artsy-fartsy. That's seventh... 12-year-olds know this.
Yes.
That movie needed one really badly.
Yes.
I will say this, people. You know what I wanted to say about the end of that? By the way, you pointed this out the last scene. It's really interesting. When he stops being able to read minds, they make an interesting decision, because he could have gotten so good at it that perhaps even when he can't read minds, he knows.
Right.
But once he stops being able to read minds, it's like he's like openly like, I have no idea what women think. Which, right. On one hand, you could make the argument, no, you'd probably at least remember or have a sense of what women are thinking.
Yeah.
On the other hand, women are completely impossible to understand, and without reading their minds, I think it is impossible. He doesn't gain the magical ability to read women's minds, but he does gain empathy and an ability to understand that he should pay attention, and he learns in that. And that makes it more realistic in that sense. Yeah. This completely unrealistic and frothy, stupid movie becomes more realistic because of that. I always think it's funny when they do something where someone, where you can read someone's mind and they're having perfect, complete thoughts.
Right, right.
Because I don't have those at all.
It's true. It's true.
And I will say, folks, if you think that this podcast is all over the place, that just shows you how chock full of ridiculousness this movie is.
Yeah, so is the movie.
But I recommend it, I think.
I know. I do too.
I don't know. What's next? What are the next 3 weeks? What do we got?
Next 3 weeks, We Were Soldiers. First time seeing it. I'm excited to see it. We Were Soldiers. Week after that, Signs. Very excited to rewatch that. And The Singing Detective 3 weeks from now. Two out of these three movies, never seen before. Very excited.
When's Passion coming in?
Shortly. Soon.
Because I realize that we always look at the actress filmography, and that's not in there. So it's like I forget that it's coming up.
No, I got it. We're on lockdown. I got
you. I trust you. I trust you.
I appreciate that. Within the next, let's see. It's the week after The Singing Detective. It's a month
from now. Okay, so number four. All right. Yeah.
So there you go.
It's What? So we were soldiers.
Signs,
and the singing detective.
Yep.
What an interesting triumvirate.
I know, right? So, and then we get into The Passion of the Christ, and immediately after that, Apocalypto, and that is not only are they back-to-back movies he's not in but directed, but that's also when
his it's the beginning and the end for Mel Gibson as a human.
Off the rails, yes.
Yeah.
Yes. So, we have that to look forward to. But in the meantime, this has been another Second Breakfast installment of Project Melway brought to you by the Gibsonian Institute. I'm Andy Roth, and that's Phil Duvall. We'll see you again real soon. Bye-bye.
Bye, everybody.
The most important meal of the day, Second Breakfast.